Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith, author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of 9 books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, and The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy. His blog, oftwominds.com, has logged millions of page views and is in the top 10 of CNBC's top alternative finance site. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. It's always my pleasure to be on the program.
Great. I thought today we'd do a focus on what many are seeing as a loss of faith in government institutions in particular, government in general, and the thesis behind this, what is driving this, and what are the implications to the economy and to the financial markets.
Sounds like a great topic. I know before we started recording, you were explaining that this is one of Martin Armstrong's core theses about the next few years. And so maybe you can kind of take the lead and summarize the Armstrong's perspective on loss of faith in institutions.
Yes, he's one of the most vocal people that are mentioning this thesis, and so he sees it as stemming from a number of sources, and we'll explore those. But importantly, also he looks at the implications of this to the economy, to the financial markets, and in particular, a movement away from public assets towards private assets. So. Public assets, meaning anything government makes or produces, like in terms of currencies, bonds, whereas private assets would be equities and also things like precious metals. So, yeah, let's take a look at what is driving this. So, you know, we can break it down into a number of categories. So, we've got growing political dysfunction, discontent, polarization at the political front that's driving this loss of faith in government institutions. We've also got economic factors in terms of purchasing power loss, and you've got a number of charts to share on that. We've got also the limits of what central banks have been doing and how they've painted themselves into a corner. So we've got dysfunction at the central banking point. We've also got dysfunction in government pensions. So, you know, we see this happening, especially in jurisdictions like Chicago or the state of Illinois, other states, where municipalities are running into problems with unfunded liabilities. An emerging government pension crisis in many jurisdictions of the Western world. So, if you'd like to start off with some of your charts that you've shared and how you see these drivers pushing a loss of faith in government institutions.
Right. Okay, great. I think I'd start out by setting two kind of contexts that seem to be global in their reach. In other words, we could look at every place from China to Japan to the EU to the US to emerging markets and find these same elements or characteristics of the relationship between the public and government. And there's a general sense of loss of trust in the government's narrative. In other words, the governments around the world in general are saying everything's fine, the status quo is working great for everyone, and there's very low inflation, wages are rising, and the economy's doing very well for everybody. But And we get the feeling that they're adjusting these statistics to support their narrative rather than really giving us the truth, which is probably considerably less rosy. And so we feel like we're being either manipulated or lied to as a means of supporting the those few who are benefiting, you know, from the status quo. And also to kind of mask the reality that the general public has been politically disenfranchised. And in other words, you go to the polls and you in a democracy and you vote for somebody else, but the status quo never changes. And so, you know, there's that sense that we're politically disenfranchised. And so if you feel that you really have lost your political voice and your financial, you know, voting power as well, then you're gonna lose faith in those institutions. And so I'm going to start with this chart of political polarization and income inequality, and we can see that the two track each other very closely. In other words, political polarization is highly correlated to the rise in income inequality, which I think we can conclude that political polarization is just one indicator of the stress that occurs when people lose confidence in governance in general, right? Then they start trying to vote for somebody on the extremes because voting for people in the middle of the spectrum hasn't changed anything. And then I have a chart here about wages and healthcare costs, which is unique to the United States. But I think in general, this loss of purchasing power of earned income is global. In other words, globally, governments are understating the loss of purchasing power and the stagnation of wages. And we can see this in the worker share of national income, which has really plummeted in the U.S., but it's declined even in Europe. We're constantly being told that everything is normal, and like the Federal Reserve here in the U.S. is added almost over $3 trillion to its balance sheet, and then it's reduced it rather modestly, and it's already declared that it's going to end that reduction in its balance sheet and then call it normal. But it's clearly not normal. So once again, we have a sense that we're not really being told the truth. We're being told what's politically expedient to support the idea that the status quo is functioning and doing a great job for everyone involved. There's the chart here I have of financial GDP and GDP and employment. And the basic idea here is if you subtract out the financial sector, most of which flows to the top 0.1%, then GDP is in the U.S. has actually been flat. In fact, it tracks employment, which has also been flat. So once again, we're told this statistic of GDP is up 42% in the last decade, which would sort of make us believe that we're 42% better off. But in actual fact, most people are worse off, right? Their earnings are stagnant, and they're not 42% better off. That there's all the gains that have been registered are in the financial manipulation sector, and those flow to the top of the wealth power pyramid. And we see that in this chart of the fruits of financialization, that most of the income gains over the last decade have flowed to the very top of the wealth pyramid, the top 0.1%. So is there any wonder why people have lost faith in institutions when you look at this, when you look at all the things that are going on in the real economy that the government is attempting to mask or hide or massage, you know, to fit a simplistic and false narrative?
Yeah, that's a great chart. You've got some others as well that shows at the same time the overall loss in purchasing power and how income is just not keeping up with rising expenses.
Right. And so the way I look, when I hear you describe Martin Armstrong's thesis, It includes this idea that the loss of faith and institutional failure is going to occur first in Europe and possibly Japan, and that would trigger a massive capital flow into the U.S., which, despite its own loss of public faith, is still in better shape, you know, economically than Europe and Japan. Maybe you can describe that, how the loss of institutional functionality and loss of public faith is going to drive capital flows going forward.
Yeah, sure. So what he's saying is, at the highest level, it's just a movement from public assets to private assets. So the idea that, if you're into government bonds or government-based currencies, there'll be a movement out of that, away from that, and more into equities and into things like tangible assets, precious metals. As you mentioned, with the U.S. being relatively okay compared to other countries, due to the fact that they're willing to kick the can down the road with more money printing, more quantitative easing, they could be the last to go in terms of an emerging financial crisis phase two. So what he sees is a scenario developing where things happen first out of Europe, driven especially by the problems with the euro currency. There's no fiscal union there. The European Central Bank has reached the limits of anything it can do. A lot of countries have borrowed from each other. There's a significant amount of debt, emerging pension crisis there as well, at a significantly worse state than even where the situation is in the U.S. And so what he sees is an emerging euro crisis in Europe, in the European Monetary Union, resulting in overall movement away from the euro and towards the U.S. dollar. Also, this is being driven by a strengthening U.S. dollar due to U.S. dollar denominated debt internationally. So that's likely to make things worse. We saw today emerging market currencies breaking down in different countries as well. So it's all happening quite rapidly now. And the end result of this, he sees, is a international capital flows towards U.S. markets, U.S. equity markets, as well as non-European monetary union markets, so Switzerland, Scandinavia, Norway, as well. That there's some movement there, but generally overall to the U.S. equity market.
Right. I think that's fascinating, and I've been a dollar bull for many years, which was often an unpopular view, because people look at the problems in the U.S. and they kind of extrapolate those problems, and then they declare that the dollar should collapse, right? And in actual fact, I think it's the opposite, as you're describing. And I think we can quantify this a little bit in a couple of ways, and I'd like to talk to that if we could. Is if we look at the yields on government bonds, of course, the U.S. is really up there. I mean, you can get almost 3% still compared to getting 0.25% or 0.5% elsewhere, right? So it's just it makes financial sense to lock in a higher yield if you can, right, if you're a global money manager. And if you see what you described, which is the U.S. dollar shortage, you know, there's a scarcity because so much money has been borrowed, denominated in dollars. So there's a global demand for dollars that is simply not there for the euro, yen, or yuan, right? It's none of those currencies have been borrowed basically as heavily as the U.S. denominated debt. So you're actually getting a double benefit here if you buy a U.S. Treasury, because you're going to pick up any gains in the dollar as the dollar appreciates against other currencies, and you're going to pick up the higher yield. So there's that. And then if you look at the just some really basic measures of U.S. central bank leverage. And like, for instance, if you take the balance sheets of the central banks and you compare them with the GDP, you know, the U.S. is relatively low. I mean, the GDP is 20 trillion and the Fed's balance sheet is, you know, 3.5 trillion or something. So by any measure of just kind of generalized security of the economy and the banking system, then the U.S. is definitely less leveraged and has more buffer, if you will, compared to these other economies. You know, like for instance, even China, where everybody is feeling very confident that China is growing again and so on, but they have like over 40 trillion in debt, and they're with a, you know, GDP that by some measures is still, you know, smaller than the U.S. And so they're really leveraged out there. And the other thing that we talked about real quickly before we started recording, which is the euro zone is one mechanism, right? The shared you know, cross border trade and employment flows and that kind of thing, the reduction of tariffs and so on. But the euro as a currency is another structure, and that many of us have felt for years is flawed, because it extends this currency to completely different and diverse nations, and then there's no fiscal controls over that currency. So it strips away the power from individual nations to you know, adjust, if you will, their economy by letting their currency weaken. And so it really doesn't seem to work on a fundamental level. And so maybe we could say in a way that what many of us have been talking about since 2011 and 12 crisis in the Eurozone, that it's finally getting to the point where stuff is going to start breaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this all is contributing to central bank dysfunction to the point of, you know, coming out towards a loss of faith in government institutions, all of the results are going in that direction. The bond market, especially in Europe, is just totally dysfunctional. You know, from the European Central Bank, they've gone to negative interest rates, and the limits of what they can do by a quantitative easing. Same thing in Japan. So those two areas in particular seem to be problem points at the moment, much worse than what the U.S. situation is.
Right. And, you know, I think it's a great comment you just made about the limits of monetary easing policy, right? Lowering interest rates and buying assets. And so then the other way that governments attempt to solve problems is they through fiscal stimulus, right? They try to borrow, you know, 5% of the GDP or something and flood their economies with government spending. But if your bond market's dysfunctional, then you're not able to sell bonds and to support, you know, this kind of very high fiscal deficit spending, you know, to boost your economy that way. So it's if the bond market stops functioning, then governments won't be able to spend so, how do we call it, so generously by borrowing money in the bond market. So that I think could be a real problem. And of course, people are always looking at interest rates, but if nobody wants to buy the bonds, and then the central bank is having to monetize the bonds for the government to spend, you know, fiscal stimulus, you know, where is the limit there? And of course, many of us have looked at Japan and said, well, is there any limit on how much money the central bank can monetize, you know, government debt? And so we may be running into those limits as well.
Exactly. And there's one chart I'd like to contribute as well. It's from a Gallup poll done a little bit earlier this year, where they did a poll of Americans trying to name what the greatest problem is facing the U.S. And 35% of Americans name government or leadership or politicians as the greatest problem facing the U.S. This number has been actually increasing over time. There's a great chart they have from their poll that we'll have available on the website, which shows how in the early 2000s, that number was only around 8%, 9% range, 10%. And then it's just steadily gotten worse over the years, increasing to about 15% in 2010, 2011, up to about 20% in 2013, 2015. And then more recently going much higher, so from 25 to 30 to 35 currently. So, Martin Armstrong also made a point of this, that it was back in the, I believe, in the Civil War that the number, once the number gets up to 45%, the Revolutionary War against the British, for revolutions to happen, if the number gets about to the 45% range, that's when things happen. So we're not that far away from there, between 35% to 45%.
Right. And you know, I just want to mention kind of anecdotally that this loss of faith in institutions, I think, arguably is extending even beyond government, in the sense that, say, the higher education admissions scandal in the U.S., where private institutions as well as public universities have been caught up in this basically corruption scandal. And so I think this people are looking at even private institutions and feeling that they're no longer trustworthy. And so it's like an erosion of the entire social contract. And one other quick comment about government, loss of faith in government is, like, I live part-time in California, and you know, California has very high taxes on virtually everything. I mean, it's got one of the highest sales tax, really high property tax, really high income tax, and very expensive fees for everything from, you know, that having to do with the state and at the local government. And yet they're throwing billions of dollars at things like traffic congestion and public education and homelessness. And yet none of these things ever seem to get better.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think that's in people's day-to-day real world life, they look at that, they're sitting in tremendous traffic congestion. They're standing up on the subway. They're seeing all this public infrastructure crumble or decay or simply not work very well. And yet they've passed billions and billions of dollars worth of bonds. The taxes keep going up. And so there's a sense, I think, that's growing that government is incapable of solving the problems. Now, whether it's from corruption or incompetence or the problems are simply unsolvable, whatever the nature of it, people are now saying the government is no longer functioning. And so when you use this word dysfunctional, I think we can apply that extremely broadly. Like, people really don't care if it's dysfunctional from personal corruption of the insiders. I mean, they know about that, or some other insider sweetheart deals, or whether it's just general incompetence. And so whatever the cause, people are no longer believing that government can do what it's supposed to do for them. And they don't have a representative voice. They feel like, you know, in many states like California, it's a one-party state, right? It's basically like the equivalent of the Soviet Union. Or some other communist regime. There's one party that rules, and even in other states that supposedly have, you know, two-party representation, whoever you vote for, nothing ever gets better. So, and I think that sense, I think, is very widespread, which is why these outsiders have won elections in France, like Macron, and the Ukraine and Italy. Around the world, people are so desperate for representation that they're voting for complete outsiders, people that are outside the party system and so on. So we're seeing, I think, lots of signs of that loss of public faith.
Yes, exactly. Resulting, this is a global phenomenon resulting in throwing the incumbents out everywhere towards politicians that have not been career politicians, but you know, maybe comedians like in Italy and the Ukraine that are actually getting elected now. So it's actually a global phenomenon. In your recent, most recent book, Pathfinding Our Destiny, you actually highlight also how government is captive to special interests and big money threatening the democracy. So there's a lot of issues there where it's driving that disenfranchisement feeling amongst the citizenry.
Yeah, absolutely. And we see just example after example of some wealthy Silicon Valley type, or corporation pouring, you know, millions of dollars into some lobbying thing and hiring, you know, hotshot attorneys and so on to basically change the regulatory structure in Washington to, like, basically let them continue to do whatever they need to do to make to maximize their personal profit, you know, at the expense of the public interest. And people, obviously, it's like, how can you look at this and not lose faith in these institutions? And, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, government has always been corrupt and there's always been, you know, private money and lobbyists. But I think the average person may be unaware of the explosion. It's like an order of magnitude increase in lobbying and money pouring into these politicians' campaigns and into lobbying. And so there used to be, I believe, I don't recall the exact numbers, but you've probably seen the same statistic that there used to be several hundred lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and now I believe there's something like 12,000. Yeah. You know, and they're all just giving away millions and millions of dollars, right? Because, and so, you know, something we've touched on and I touched on in my book is the system is breaking down because centralization itself is the problem. If you try to, if you aggregate all the power and capital into the hands of a few people at the top, whether it be government or government private, then they're very liable to corruption and policy errors because you're not drawing upon the expertise you get if the system is decentralized, right, where local communities and smaller banks and so on can solve their own problems by being flexible and adjusting and adapting to their local realities. So I don't think that you can say, this is my personal opinion, I don't think you can say, oh, if only we elected a comedian here or something, that problem is going to be solved. I think that the government is too powerful and has too many controls over capital to be anything other than dysfunctional. And I think I think people are starting to awaken to that it's the government's structure. It's not just who we elected. That really is, turns out to not really matter that much, whether you call it the deep state or the central state or whatever. So I think we're really talking about a structural problem that has not yet been recognized.
Mm-hmm. And in your book, you mentioned that to find that way to a better destiny, we must create new localized structures optimized for resilience and adaptability. So as you just mentioned, something that's more flexible, decentralized, sustainable, democratic, opportunity for all type of characteristics. How can we do the transition from where we are today towards that?
Right. And, you know, I don't want to be cheating here, but I do want to mention that you and I are going to be talking about agile technologies in our next program next month. But I tend to think there's going to have to be a disruption of the centralized status quo to kind of open up some room for other solutions. And so, you know, this crisis we're talking about where people just lose faith in the bond market and then that breaks down and then government funding breaks down, that when these large scale centralized structures break down, then people are going to be more open to trying some other solution, because, you know, human nature being what it is, if you can just kind of stick with what you know, the devil you know is, you know, is better than the devil you don't know. That's kind of, you know, and so people will stick with a dysfunctional system until it breaks down. So it's like too bad that's probably the way it's going to be, but we may have to have a financial and governmental crisis, which will open up people's minds really and willingness to take a look at some more decentralized solutions.
Yeah, that's the way forward, as you conclude in your book, that better options are available if we're willing to explore.
Yes, that's right.
Well, it's been a great discussion, Charles, and how can our listeners learn more about your work?
Please visit me at oftwominds.com. There's free sample chapters of my book and extensive archives. Take a look. It's all free.
Great. Excellent. And as you mentioned, for our next discussion, we'll go into more detail on actual solutions, technologies that are happening that can be put in place to help meet your vision of you know, a more decentralized, sustainable, and democratic institution where there can be an increasing faith in those institutions.
Yeah, terrific summary for next month. Well, thank you very much, Richard.
Great. Thank you, Charles.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.